Welcome to another episode of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. I am, as always, your semi-helpful host, Director of Online Content here at SimSec, Matthew Hippel. Now today we have some good news and some bad news. The good news is that Captain Peter Schwartz will be joining us. Retired Navy captain at the Center for Naval Analysis, he is well known in circles of strategy and Navy policy. But today, he's going to bring us a story more personal than policy. We interviewed him on his time in Vietnam, from field operations to staff work in Saigon, working for Admiral Zumwalt, how he met his wife in country, and his family's dealings with the fall of Saigon in 75. The bad news is, the computer ate half of the podcast. We lost some of the material on how he got interested in Vietnam, what brought him into the Navy, and how he ended up in the Vietnam War, and unfortunately, a large amount of his perspective on his strange new life in a country that held his interest, but that he was seeing for the first time during war. Now don't worry, we will circle back around to him to get that story again, but today we meet him at the halfway point. To bring you up to speed, Lieutenant Schwartz now is a liaison officer with the Vietnamese Navy in Phu Quoc Island. He is receiving some captain callers from Saigon who want him to implement a new social welfare program. Lieutenant Schwartz, however, was brought to Vietnam to implement the Vietnamization training program, and he tells them to head back to Saigon and use the Vietnamese chain of command to get the message to the Vietnamese unit he was liaison for, since, you know, that was the whole point of why they sent him out there in the first place, to get the Vietnamese chain of command to work. So, without further ado, we roll right into the halfway point of our interview with Captain Schwartz. You were in the middle of talking about why don't we exercise the Vietnamese chain of command.
Exactly. So, that was my shtick. And these visitors from Saigon, who were pretty high-powered, they were captains, came down from Saigon to see how things were doing, and I shot my mouth off about how this was a metaphor for everything that was wrong with the war. We had to exercise the Vietnamese chain of command, not the American chain of command, and they weren't doing their job. They were just trying to get everything done, but getting everything done wasn't going to win the war. And so that was that. And I went back to sleep, or went to my rack, and next day I got ordered to Saigon. So I didn't want to go to Saigon. I didn't come over to Vietnam to go to Saigon. And my boss said, well, if you've been ordered to Saigon, you know what? You've been ordered to Saigon. You got to go to Saigon. I said, well, this is just bullshit. I'm a reserve. I came over here to do this job. I had this all gamed and all set up. I've been doing the job. And now they want me to go to Saigon. So I left all my gear, my stuff, stereo, all the stuff you buy when you're over there in those days, because you could buy all kinds of stuff from the PX. That was another thing, the PX. Don't get me started on that. I had all this loot. And I went to Saigon, and I went in to see a captain who was head of the advisory unit there. And he said, well, I'm glad you're here. We got a place for you. We want you to work on all this new pig and chicken program and psychological operations and political warfare, all the things that are going along with the turning over of things to the Vietnamese, and you're just the man for it. And I said, no, I'm absolutely not the man for it. I belong where I just came from. I don't want this job. I'm uninterested in it, and find somebody else. And here's a whole bunch of other guys I know in country that would really like to be in Saigon, and you ought to get one of them. And he said, no, we want you. And I said, well, that's very flattering, but no thanks. And they said, I don't think you understand, Lieutenant. You're here, and you're a lieutenant, and you're here, and here's your boss, Commander John Walker, a Princeton ROTC graduate, incidentally. And he came over here thinking he was going to be the senior advisor to the Vietnamese Navy Fleet Command, which were the LSTs and the PGMs, and soon to be the DE that the Vietnamese were getting. And instead, he'd been roped into being the head advisor for all of this turnover and social welfare programs and whatnot that Zumwalt was pushing. And I was going to be his main guy. And I said, well, okay, good for him, but no. And they said, this is your desk. This is where you sit. I said, well, all my stuff is in Antwerp. They said, well, bad judgment on your part. I don't know how you're ever going to get it because we got a lot of things for you to do. I don't know when you're going to get back to Android. But let me ask you something. This is all heading someplace. Let me ask you something, Lieutenant. Why are you so down on coming to Saigon? Every other lieutenant in Vietnam we would have talked to would have given his left ear to go to Saigon, and not you. And, of course, that's one of the things that's endearing you to us. And this is a true story. I said, you know, there's three reasons. Number one, this place is a flesh pot. You guys don't spend all your time dealing with work. You spend all your time in bars, and you've all got girlfriends. And, hey, I'm single, and I'm out there, and I know where to go and what to do. It's a country full of beautiful women and men that have all been shanghaied into the army or the other army. And I'm fine on that regard, but I don't want to come. This is Sodom and Gomorrah. I didn't come over to Vietnam to do this. Second of all, you know, you guys are doing staff work, and I came over here to be an operator. Navy's about operators. I'm doing operations. I'm fine with that. I'm not in the Navy for a career. I just want to be over here doing the kinds of things I'm doing. I'm not much of an operator, but I like being with the operators, and I'm supporting them, and I'm doing good work, and so I'm okay. And then, you know, I'm noticing this ring on your finger, and you know, you guys up here are all the lifers. And guys out in the woods are all of the reserves. That isn't accurate, but that was my view at the time. And begging your pardon, but I'm just not interested in socializing and hanging around with a whole bunch of lifers. I'm getting out as soon as this tour is done. And he said, well, that's very interesting, Lieutenant. We did ask, and you did answer, and here's your desk, and you're working for John Walker, and get busy. You're already late and behind. So what happened? Well, first of all, a friend of mine, we'll go into the story a little more, introduced me to a young lady in Saigon, who I moved in with shortly thereafter. And I'm still living with her, as a matter of fact, and we've been married over 40-some-odd years. Exactly what I was trying to avoid, I walked into and fell very, very hard, fortunately. Changed my whole life for the better. Very happy about all of that. Second of all, at the same time, I discovered something about myself that I had not realized before, had never known it. And that was that while I wasn't that much of an operator, which was true, and although I liked the operations and supporting operators, I was really a dynamite staff officer. I could whip stuff into shape, figure out how to coordinate a paper, figure out how to get things done, get something through the admiral, write up something fast, boil it all down to a page. I could do all that staff stuff like falling out of bed. And most other Navy guys couldn't and didn't give a damn. But for me, it was glory. And I hadn't known that. So I became a pretty good staff officer on the COMNAV-4V staff. And then finally, because I was a good staff officer, I caught the eye of Admiral Zumwalt and some of the other senior people, all of whom had big rings on their fingers. And I learned that they weren't such a bad group of people after all, that actually they were patriots and servants of the country, and some of them were wise. They were all ambitious and energetic at that level. And I was pretty impressed with them and enjoyed working for them. Changed my whole life. So the trajectory after that was, I wound up staying in the Navy because Admiral Zumwalt asked me to. Then I stayed in the Navy even though he was gone, and had a very successful career, largely as a staff officer, something that you can't do in the Navy, but I did. Second of all, I came back to the United States, couldn't live without Twi, wrote her a letter, said come to the United States. She did. We got married right away at Naval Air Station Alameda. Our wedding party consisted of the coming home shenanigans of the USS Hancock, which you just pulled in, having just served a tour off North Vietnam. So the pilots were semi-hysterical, and we had quite a time. And I stayed in the Navy for a career, wound up working for a succession of ring knockers, most of whom I enjoyed working for and supporting. So the Twi part of the story is that I had a group of colleagues that were quite a bunch that were working on this problem of Vietnamese Navy welfare. And this welfare program was dead serious. The desertion problem was awful. And if we couldn't figure out a way to keep the Vietnamese Navy guys on base, all of whom were married and all had kids, we just weren't going to have any force to man any of these things. And so we had to be able to figure out a way to bring families to the bases. And the American government military assistance program wasn't giving pig farms and rice fields and other things as part of its largesse. And you couldn't explain to anybody why they should. And so we were doing everything we could. Admiral Zumwalt, we set up a private foundation to raise money in the States. I came back to the States and had a speaking tour, which I wound up crossing paths, if not swords, with John Kerry. We did all kinds of things in order to put together this Vietnamese Navy veterans, if they got wounded and were lame, well, that was it. Too bad. So why would you risk your life if you knew that nobody was going to take care of you if you wound up with one leg? Well, there was one guy, an American Navy lieutenant, who came back to Vietnam as a civilian. He had one leg because he'd stepped on a mine when he was a riverine advisor. And he was trying to build a little town for Vietnamese Navy veterans so that there was sort of like a veterans home. And he and I became friends, and he had a girlfriend. His girlfriend was the most beautiful woman in Vietnam. She would, and in a country full of beautiful women, she stood out. Her name was Mai. Her name is still Mai. And she was gorgeous. And she had a sister. And was I interested in meeting the sister? So I'd like to meet the sister. So I met the sister. Actually, Matt, you've met the sister. The sister was certainly attractive. Was not the most beautiful woman in Vietnam, though. That was her sister. But as far as I was concerned, as I came to know her, I thought she was the smartest person in Vietnam. I thought that Trump being the most beautiful person in Vietnam any time. And as I learned later when I went back to the States without her, I couldn't really live without her. Sent her a note, asked her to come. She sent me a scathing reply at how dumb I was. She knew we were going to get married. How come I didn't know we were going to get married? Now that she was stuck in Vietnam and I was back in the United States, did I have any idea how much money it was going to cost for her to get out of Vietnam? And blah, 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 blah. So I was kind of taken aback by all of that. But I said, I'd still like you to come. And she did, and we got married. And two children, several moves, Navy career. Her career was a daycare provider. And here we are sitting in the same house in Burke, Virginia that we've lived in for 25 years. Having gone back to Vietnam a couple of times and having had a wonderful reunion with Admiral Kim, which we can talk about also, Captain Kim, rather. So that's kind of the love story, how it intertwined with the career pattern and the career story. I wound up staying in the Navy. My different lists that I was on for CIA, State Department, and USIA all lapsed or wound up expiring or whatever. We got a job in London. I got a job in London, which I went to as a lieutenant. Now, everything I've just described to you is very interesting, but none of it is a Navy career. So it was pretty clear that when I got to London after a couple of years and I was up for lieutenant commander, that I would be passed over. And that was fine for me. We were going to go to law school. I'd applied to several law schools. I was going to get $15,000 worth of separation pay, which in 1973 or whenever it was a lot of money. And we were going to then get shipped back to the United States early because I wasn't going to stay in London, having been passed over. And that was going to be that. And what happened was I got promoted. And that was a big shock to most people. It was certainly a shock to me and to Twee. And we had to figure out what we were going to do. But that's another whole set of stories as to how that all transpired and how I wound up talking to you now and became the guy that you know me as, the maritime strategy guy.
So just so we're not worried here, sir, I absolutely plan to bring you back for many of the stories you've bookmarked here. Though, if it's any indication, at the beginning of the podcast, you had wondered how the balance between policy and romance story. My wife is listening into this interview, and she did look over and start smiling goofily during your story. So I think you've effectively told that story. Yeah, she's giving a thumbs up. But so while all this is going on,
hi, Martha.
He says hi, Martha. Hi. She's waving back, and she waves to all of you in the podcast audience as well. I won't bother editing this out. But what I'd like to hit on specifically now is I'm sure Thuy had family back in Vietnam in the Spring Offensive of 1975 and the fall of Saigon. What was that like for your family? Because, you know, the Schwartz family now is, you know, includes Thuy's family, and it spans an ocean, and now this is happening to the country where she's from. What was that like for the two of you?
Okay, so 1975, I'm in London, and so Thuy's in London, and we have taken a vacation, and we're in Venice. So we're sitting on the in the restaurants on the canal, and we're eating polenta and squid ink, which is the delicious stuff that you eat in Venice, and we're reading the New York Herald Tribune. And we're reading about the fall of Saigon. So that's where we are when Saigon falls. Now, then I got to back up a bit. So Thuy is one of, I'm going to get this wrong, six or seven sisters, one brother. And the older ones were all conventional Vietnamese who married Vietnamese and did that. And the younger ones, and this is the bust up of society that happens when you're in a war like this. The younger ones had all learned in various degrees to deal with Americans. And so Thuy had two sisters who married Americans. Mai, the most beautiful woman in Vietnam, hadn't quite done that yet, I don't think, but she will. And her youngest sister, Lien, had married a guy who was a former Marine named Hal Schultz. And Lien and Hal lived somewhere, I forget where, New Jersey or Hawaii or someplace, and he was a civilian working for the Department of the Army. He was like a GS-9 or 11 or 13 or something like that, and he fixed radars for them, and he was an old Vietnam hand from way back and a retired Marine. And while Thuy and I are sitting in Venice reading about this holler that's going on in Saigon, Hal is getting on a plane and flying back to Saigon. And I'm calling London, and people have assured me that were I to fly back to Saigon to get the family out, brothers and sisters and nephews and nieces and everybody, that I will be thrown out of the Navy and probably jailed, because I'm a naval officer and we're not allowed to do that. And so I'm fit to be tied, and I'm telling Thuy, hey, I guess I'm just going to go. I don't know what the hell else to do. We got to try to get everybody out. And Thuy calls Lien. Now, remember, this is the day before cell phones. Every one of these phone calls calling from Venice is kind of a hassle. And Thuy calls her sister, Lien, and Lien said, tell Peter he doesn't have to worry. Hal went back, and he's getting everybody out. I said, how the hell is Hal going to get everybody out? And the answer, of course, is because Hal is a Marine. Hal got 44 out of the 45 brothers, sisters, brothers-in-law, sisters-in-law, nephews and nieces out of Vietnam. The only guy that didn't come out of Vietnam with Hal was one nephew who was up in Dalat, who was with a girl, it's always a girl, and didn't get back to Saigon in time, although he could have and should have. And so he was left behind. But Hal got everybody on a plane while all hell was breaking loose in Tan Son Nhut. They wound up in Guam. They wound up, when I visited them, and I don't remember exactly when this was, when we visited them in New Jersey, he was at Fort Monmouth working for the Army, and he had a house that had a basement that was full of nothing but bunk beds, miles of bunk beds, for all of this extended family. My brother-in-law was a hero and at first class, and he got, however he did it, everybody out except one, and it wasn't his fault that he didn't get that one out, and all of Thuy's sisters and brother today are here in the States. Some have passed on. One has passed on. Nephews and nieces are here. They're all over the country. They live in Philadelphia and Las Vegas and Hawaii and New Jersey and Florida and Texas, everywhere. And they're all U.S. citizens, and some are doing spectacularly well. Some are doing just moderately well. But I wound up not having to get involved directly in all of that, although it had been my intent to. Hal did it all.
Wow.
That's what I said.
Now, for a lot of what we've heard today, I'd also recommend to everyone Brown Water, Black Berets, another USNI book by Thomas Cutler. That's fantastic, and that's what got me personally interested into Vietnam and sir, stories like yours. And let me ask you here, and I'll ask you here on the podcast. I think that's all right. Is Hal still around? I want to hear that story.
No, he passed on. Hal was considerably older than me and considerably older than his wife, and he passed on several years ago. But he had done this this amazing thing of going back and getting people out when explosions were rampant and North Vietnamese tanks were in the street and all of that. And we're sitting there watching it out, feeling like dumbasses, because here we are sitting having a good time in Venice, acting the tourist on a break from my staff work in London, while on the other side of the world, a world that we knew very well, that my wife knew intimately and I knew a bit, it was falling apart. And yet he was able to salvage practically everything. And incidentally, the guy that was left, he eventually came to the United States, and he's in the States today.
Any final thoughts for our audience before we move on today?
I got to understand this later on as the story about my career unfolded, but this is an example of I really became addicted to the Navy. The experiences, the people, the fact that we were doing something for the country and for other people, all of that I think comes through in the story, and it came through to me. And I began to realize that I had to figure out some way to carve out a career in the Navy. I was no longer a graduate student aiming to be a foreign service officer. I was way past that by then. I was something that had lots of Navy in it, but I wasn't doing real Navy things yet. And I had to sort of figure out how to do that, because my experience had been so positive as a naval officer. I'd met such amazing people, like the senior naval advisor who became a mentor, like John Walker, who was my boss, like my colleague and later brother-in-law, Bob Kay, the one-legged pirate, the other folks that I had met, certainly Admiral Zumwalt and his wife and his family, who had all been wonderful. And Admiral Zumwalt especially, he and his wife had, because his wife was a foreigner, was a Russian, who he met in China, in Shanghai, in 1945, she could not have been more gracious to Tui and I when we all wound up in Washington together. He is the CNO and me is just some lieutenant with Tui. They would invite us to their home. I was involved in a speaking program in which he would invite me over to talk to people about what is this madman Kerry doing throwing his medals at the Capitol. There were other lieutenants in Vietnam, and they came out kind of different, and they had a different view of the war and of the Vietnamese that they were trying to help and to save and to protect and to fight with, alongside of what I mean. And so I wouldn't say we were close to the Zumwalts, but they always knew who we were. We always knew who they were, and they were people we could always count on. I think if he were alive today listening to this, he'd look at me and say, no, of course we were close. He was that kind of guy.
Wow. Well, sir, I hope you'll accept our open-ended invitation here to come back in the future. But really, thank you so much for bringing your story to me and to the audience today. It's been a really great ride.
Okay, well, thank you very much for inviting me. One of the aspects of the Navy that I most enjoyed then was the company of lieutenants when I was a lieutenant. And one of the aspects of the Navy that I most enjoy now, when I'm 20 years retired from being a captain, is the company of active duty lieutenants. So thank you very much for inviting me and inviting Tui as well.
Do you like the Sea Control podcast? Sure, we all do. However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SimSec website. Sign up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. Seriously, how do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?